gentlemen, I present to you the biggest thorn in the establishment side, Ron Paul.
Me several times the same question. What is it about Montana, the people of Montana, that likes what you've been saying? I said, well, maybe they love liberty in Montana. Now the opposite of liberty is big government. So if we want more liberty, we have to shrink the size of our government. People worry about, you know, this radical idea. To me, it doesn't sound radical. It sounds like a very modest thing to do. And that is, you know, getting rid of the income tax. That's just a modest thing. Well, if we get rid of the income tax, they'd worry about, well, how are we going to finance government? Where are we going to get the money? They say, well, why don't we just shrink the size of government to the point where we don't need an income tax? Quite understand it. They haven't read their history books, and they didn't realize that we've only had the income tax since 1913. I think we could live without it. Matter of fact, the government, our federal government, is still getting as much money. They would still get as much money today without an income tax as they had 10 years ago. Wasn't the size of government plenty big enough 10 years ago? So it could not be a problem. The issue is that we have to decide, and you as young people have to decide, and that is, what should the role of government be? Should the role of government be there to run our lives and police the world and run the economy? And I would say, no way. It's time that we don't pretend that we're the policemen of the world, which means that then that gives us a good chance to save a lot of money. Right now we're in 130 countries. I would like to say we ought to be in one country defending this country. We have over 700 bases overseas, always there to protect us. But you know, we're going broke, and it's a good time, rather than waiting for the collapse of the empire. And unfortunately, that's what usually happens with governments that spread themselves too thinly around the world. They usually go broke. And just think, just recently, the Soviet system collapsed. Not because we had to have a nuclear exchange with the Soviets. They collapsed for economic reasons. And that's what's going to happen to us if we don't change our tune. We have to get our house in order. And by doing so, I mean, think of the benefits. We get our house in order, cut back the size of government, we have less taxes and more freedom. Why don't we do it? I would say it's time for a change in that direction. Every once in a while you hear other candidates talking about change, but when they do, you'll have to ask he or she, whichever it is, does that mean you're going to bring the troops home? Does that mean you will only fight wars that are declared by the Constitution and the Congress? Or will you not interfere in the economic lives of our people and the individual rights of the people? And will you have sound money again? That's what real change is. Real change, unfortunately, is just going back to what we were supposed to have done in the first place. That is follow the Constitution. A question frequently about why it is that so many people have gotten interested in the campaign, why we were able to raise so much money, and especially why young people have joined. There's a couple reasons. It's been a while since somebody has really just had a chance to talk across the country and really defend what America's all about, defending liberty and defending the Constitution. So it's sort of nice to hear that once again. But I think there's something else going on. I think it's the failure of government that is self-evident. You know, when we're a rich country, and we have been rich, we're still wealthy in the sense that we still live pretty well, but the tragedy there is that we're all living on borrowed money. The government's borrowed everything. Our country owes $3 trillion to overseas right now, so we can't even fight the war or keep the welfare state going without borrowing close to $3 billion a day. So if we're very wealthy, and we certainly were very wealthy, and then we could borrow, and then we could print, and we got away with this for so long that nobody worried too much about it. But I think the handwriting is on the wall. The American people know about it. There was a statistic that came out today that 90% of the American people said there's something seriously wrong with the economy. Yeah, in Washington, D.C., they haven't even heard about that yet. But it's very evident to the American people that we cannot continue it. They don't want us to continue fighting these no-win wars all around the world, bankrupting our country, just draining our resources, making our national defense much weaker. We're weaker for all this. If we want a strong national defense, we won't be just draining our troops and ruining and undermining all our weaponry. I mean, we're just not in good shape right now. And besides, we have more enemies than ever before. Foreign policy really gives us the vehicle if we want a transition. If we don't work for a transition to gradually shrink the size of government and getting back to work again, it'll end badly, like all other times, with runaway inflation, destruction of the money, which causes political and economic turmoil. That's what we're looking at if we don't do something. But right now, our foreign policy costs us $1 trillion a year to operate all this overseas. And it's endless. Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize winning economist, has predicted that he started off by saying the Iraqi war would cost between $1 and $3 trillion. He's now saying between $3 and $5 trillion because he adds up all the economic costs. This old economic myth that says that, you know, in times of war, you have prosperity, which is complete nonsense. The Depression wasn't ended, you know, with the World War II. The Depression ended after World War II ended. So this idea that you have a war economy, you spend $100 billion or $500 billion for weaponry, you send the weapons over and you bomb somebody. And then you have to pay to rebuild what you bomb, and it drains. That's why we're poor. That's why we can't afford our education benefits. We can't afford our medical care. We don't have our good jobs because we are wasting so much money overseas. Now, what we can do, if we decide, rightfully so and as soon as possible, we should start in the most important things to do, and that is end this war. Yes. This war. Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, that he had something to do with 9/11, and that we were obligated to teach them about democracy. I would say we ought to teach a few people in this country about democracy. The reason we have to end it is because the more we spend on bombing countries like Iraq, then we pay for that. And then they come back, the government comes back to us, taxes us again so that we go over and rebuild Iraq. At the same time, we're building bridges in Iraq. Our own bridges are falling down. I say take care of our bridges and our infrastructure here in this country. But we need to bring those troops home. We do not need to any longer threaten the Iranians. I mean, they're not a model nation. But if we want to teach other people how to be a model nation, we should concentrate on improving ourselves and setting a good example so others would want to emulate us. You can't spread the much that is good about America through to the rest of the world through a barrel of gun because it cancels out all the goodness of America. But getting out of the Middle East would be one thing. But don't you think it's time we came home from Japan? Yeah. Time to go home from Korea? Yeah. Time to come home from Europe? I mean, how much longer do we have to stay there? But at the rate we're going, it looks like it's going to be when the dollar is totally destroyed. And that is what's happening today. Every single day almost, when you look at the news, the dollar's down again. Inflation is very high, much higher than the government admits, and the concern of American people is very, very great. But it's going to get a lot worse because when the dollar goes down, inflation comes back, interest rates will be coming back up, and a lot of interest rates, even though the rates that the banks pay to borrow from the Federal Reserve happens to be low, the interest rates that you have to pay if you want to go buy a house today, those rates are going up. So that is what happens when you destroy a currency. The destruction of money is a very, very important issue. When a country does that, it transfers wealth from the middle class, destroys the middle class, and transfers the wealth to the Wall Street rich class. This is what has happened over these many, many decades, these last several decades. Countries that never had a free market economy and sound money, they don't even have middle classes. But what we're witnessing today is the elimination and the wiping out of the middle class. Something has to be reversed. And it has to do with spending. It has to do with monetary policy. It has to do with the foreign policy. It has to do with this idea of welfareism. This idea that we can take care of everybody by merely having more welfare poured on us, that won't work either. This idea that once they decided that the recession was coming, well, let's send everybody either $600 or $1,200 and the recession will be prevented. You know, the politicians in Washington don't have any money. They can't tax much more. We've been taxed to the hill. It's hard to borrow anymore. So what are they going to do? Print the money. What does that do? That causes the inflation. So this whole idea rejects the whole notion of what America is all about. And that is sound money, personal liberty, property rights, voluntary contracts, and self-reliance. People willing to go out and work for themselves and knowing they can keep what they earn. That's what we need. But right now will continue to go down unless we have this reversal. The magnificent thing of this past year has been that a lot of people have rallied to the cry of more liberty, less government. And I am utterly amazed. You know, a lot of people have said that I have removed your apathy. And I am pleased I have, but people like you have removed my skepticism, because before I went in and got into the race, more than a year ago, I was very skeptical. I just believed that there wouldn't be very many people who cared, that the young people wouldn't respond. I didn't know how big the remnant, the true believers were. Because we never know how many people really believe and have been turned off and maybe not voting and not knowing there were a lot of allies out there. I think this last year has helped us discover that there are allies out there. There are a lot of people who are very interested and want to. We have many good crowds around the country, and I'm just really delighted with the nice turnout here. But I think what is so magnificent about the crowds that we have gotten is that when the people come together to hear the message of freedom and self-reliance, all of a sudden we bring different kinds of people together. People who look different, think different, they have different religion, they have different social values. And it's because in a truly free society, people don't tell other people what they're supposed to do with their lives. want to do with their money. You know, right now I'm allied with Barney Frank, who's the chairman of the banking committee, and he has this silly notion that I've joined him in, and he thinks that you ought to have the right to use the internet any way you want, and I'm all for that. Gambling for myself because I like to keep them my money, but some people like to do this internet gambling. Now, I'm in favor of allowing you to decide whether or not you want to gamble. What I'm not in favor of is the federal government telling you that you can't do it and that they use that to invade and control the internet. That's what we don't want. But the nice thing about it is it truly does bring people together. And something happened 100 years ago or so in this country. The founders gave us a pretty good understanding about what freedom was all about. Freedom, it emphasized the individual. Freedom was the individual. It wasn't a collective thing. We don't have freedom and we don't have rights because we belong to a group. We don't have rights because we're Catholics or Protestants or women or men or blacks or whites or any of this. It isn't gender or whatever. It's because we're individuals and every single individual has equal rights, and that is the reason that people who have different views, social views, can come together and say, yes, I'll fight for your freedom, you fight for my freedom, I'll leave you alone, you leave me alone, and believe me, that could be a happy society. Reason, even though the founders understood this, freedom was divided into pieces. One group decided that economic liberty was pretty important, but your liberty to decide what you want to do with your own body, what you want to smoke and drink, and whatever you want to do socially, oh, we can't trust you with that. And others would say, yes, we recognize that people should have their right to decide what they want to do with their own bodies and their own lives, but you're not smart enough to know what to do with your own money. So why isn't it just possible that we once again could put this back together again and say freedom means that the individual has a right to their life and a right to their liberty and a right to keep the fruits of their labor? Have been under systematic attack, and it's been especially bad since 2001. There has been a lot of plans even before that to attack our civil liberties. The Patriot Act was not written after 9/11. The Patriot Act was written before 9/11. 9/11 by some neoconservatives was seen as an opportunity. And they saw this and they jumped on it and they said, this is a chance for us to get the Patriot Act passed and the FISA courts and all these things that have happened. And even immediately afterwards, because they had even been planning it before it, this is the time we're going to go into Iraq. So these kind of events are very dangerous. Once you get this mentality that the people are frightened and we have to have the government take care of ourselves, to take care of us, then the majority too often then are too willing to give up their liberties. But Franklin was right. We should never, never have to give up any liberty for our security. I think most people realize that the greatest threat to our liberty is not violent invasion. Who's going to invade us? You know, it's not going to happen. Even at the height of the Cold War, the odds of an invasion were pretty minimal. They were more dangerous at that time. I was called to military duty in 1962 due to the Cuban crisis, and that was probably the height of the Cold War, but we didn't have to, you know, fight the Soviets. But it's internal threat that is the problem. It's the philosophy of the country, this attitude, what the government should be doing. And are we going to accept this idea that if we just get scared enough, we allow the government to run roughshod over us? So in times of war, whether it's war against terrorism, war against the Iraqis, or war against the Iranians, the people are supposed to roll over. And I would say it's time not to roll over, but to stand up and resist. Today has to do with the FISA courts. Senate has passed a bill that gives amnesty and gives exemption to the telecommunication systems that disobeyed the law and turned over all their records to the government just because the government asked them. They broke the law, they're liable for lawsuits, and now the Republicans, and that's not saying a whole lot right now, but the Republican Party now standing firm. What they want more than anything else is to pass FISA that exempts retroactively any telecommunications company that turned over all our records to the government so that they can never be held liable. And that right now is the most important issue on the House floor today for our side of the aisle, I'm sad to say. But just think of what that means. If the government can come in and hire companies to break the law and undermine our liberties, and then they are exempted. That means literally that they could hire some private firm, come in and invade our house and say, well, we're going to exempt it because the government asked us to do this. So our liberties are indeed threatened. We have the Patriot Act, which is a good bill that we should have all voted against, and I was proud to say I voted against. Thank you. We have warrantless searches. We have the government monitoring our internet, our telephone conversations. And if you belong to a certain group, this Domestic Terrorism Act, they talk, if you belong to a certain group where one person might have done something, you could be held liable. It is really an undermining of a lot of our civil liberties. Right now, today, we have become known around the world as a nation that tortures. This whole debate about whether or not we should waterboard or not, I think that is so sad that we've come to this point where we are the torturers of the world, and the symbol of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo is what so many others think of us around the world. And also the whole idea that the writ of habeas corpus has been repealed, essentially. We now could be hauled off into prison. It's been done two or three times now, and have no lawyer, be put in prison, and have no recourse because somebody declared you a potential terrorist. Well, you know, but most people, a lot of Americans say, oh, that's okay, we should lock up those terrorists, those are bad guys. But when every time they do that, you have to think, those are suspects. Those are suspects. And if they can do that with one American, they can do it with all of us if we're not careful, and that's why this has to be reversed. Of national sovereignty is something that I still think we should be concerned about. I still believe that we should believe it should honor national sovereignty, which means that I do not see any purpose to belong to the United Nations. World Bank or the WTO or the American Community Union. I understand either today or tomorrow the President's meeting with the President of Mexico and Canada once again on their plans. I hear they're planning a big highway or something like that. No, we don't need more government. We need less government in Washington. We need more local government. We need more liberty. You can't have more freedom by more world government. And that is what's happening. The WTO, the World Trade Organization, has already sent instructions to the United States Congress where we follow through and change our tax code because we were instructed to. That's how far along we are on this. So we don't need that. We have every right to protect our borders and defend our borders. I think that there's no reason to be hostile to immigrants. I don't think that is that we can be hostile. We can be hostile to illegal immigration. I think the whole immigration issue should be seen more in terms of economics than anything else. Because when you have a weakening economy and our good jobs are going overseas and we have a welfare state and you have to pay for the education and medical care of those who come here illegally, then it becomes a threat. It becomes a burden. If we were a truly thriving economy where those trillions of dollars we spend overseas were being spent here, there would be a need for labor. There would not be nearly the concern and the hostility. Today, when 90% of the American people believe we're in a recession and having trouble, and we see immigrants coming in as a threat, that is a big problem. But I think the first thing we should do is not reward people for coming illegally. We should not give them amnesty. The federal government should ever come down and give mandates to the individual states for you to have to provide free benefits, because that is not what America is all about. And it's a land of opportunity, and the law is going to be written. But there's this problem, I'm afraid, is going to get a lot worse, mainly not because we will just become more hostile, but because the economy is going to get worse, and it's going to be transferred. This hostility will be transferred. So, you know, we do have a lot of problems. We have the financial problems, we have the foreign policy, the monetary problems, the personal liberties problems. But, you know, the great part about all this is the problems aren't that confusing and complex, and the answers aren't that difficult either. It can be found by just following the Constitution. That's what we have to do. We need some different people in Washington. There's also the change of a country doesn't come when you convert 51% of the people. And it comes when you convert 5 or 10% of the people. And right now, I think our group in this campaign is about 10% of the people, and we're on the verge of changing the country. Why, even if you don't get the support of the mainstream media, you don't get the attention, and we tend to get marginalized in our beliefs, but if we are determined and understand and know the system and know how to do it, we'll work hard. 5 or 10 or 15%, if you're activists, if you're involved in the caucuses and the voting and local politics, you can have an impact. Because the one thing that I have noticed in this past year is that the perception of our campaign has been very, very good. You know, more signs, more people, more determination, more excitement than all the rest put together.
That's right.
Yet it hasn't been translated in, you know, to the maximum number of votes. And there's several reasons for that. Sometimes, not all the time, sometimes all the votes aren't counted. But the point here is, if a group of people are philosophically determined, you can have a much greater impact than that 80% who go out and vote at the last minute with not having understood much of what was going on, and they get their general perceptions from the evening news, and they're going to go, oh yeah, I like him, or that name is familiar, and then they go and vote. That's quite a bit different than have a significant number of people who are dedicated and understand the issues your impact can be much greater than all the rest put together. That is what I sense is happening, because people who ask, are you still in this race or aren't you? Sure, I'm still in this race. Convention. I've said on national television, anybody asked me that I'm in the race, and they said, well, why don't you drop out? You don't have enough votes. I said, well, I'm in the race. As long as the supporters want me to be in the race, it's their campaign. They've been running it most of the time anyway. And as long as there are funds in the bank for us to go about the country and do the things that we need to do, we'll stay in this race. And I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, the next day. Nobody knows what the future will bring, so time will tell, and we have a few months left. But I do know one thing. Regardless of what I do in the next 2 weeks or 2 months or 3 months or what happens in September, I do know what has happened in this past year is not going to go away. I really think it's just the beginning. Need because of the problems we face, and I do truly believe that we have the answers. I've never bragged about, nor do I think I have the key to it all. I know about my shortcomings and I know about my limitations. But one thing I also know is there's no limits to this philosophy of liberty, because under those conditions, all good things can come up, and all kinds of prosperity and peace, if we would just follow the dictates that truly are designed to protect all the rights of all individuals. But freedom is something that is relatively new. Sometimes we're accused of going back to the dark ages, especially when we bring up the issue of monetary policy. Oh yeah, you're one of those guys who want to go back to the gold standard. Of course, if we did have the opportunity to go back, you know what that means? We wouldn't even have a Federal Reserve System anymore. In terms of history, the ideas of freedom are relatively young. And much has been achieved. I mean, the Industrial Revolution and the great wealth, probably 99% of the wealth has been achieved once it was recognized what free markets and free individuals can do and how they can produce. But we're liable to lose all this. I mean, if we don't do something, we can go back to the dark ages if we're not careful. Governments aren't very good at managing things. But freedom is relatively new. And when they talk about going back to the old days, when they talk about fighting wars and tyranny, undermining a personal liberty, running an economy and high taxes, and you know, just the idea of inflation, those are old ancient ideas. The tyranny is what is ancient. We want to break away from all those old traditions. Those who claim that we're from going to the dark ages are the ones who are still living in the dark ages, and they're longing for it because there's a certain number of people who always want to rule over other people. Challenge about a free society is the responsibility that we have to assume. If we have a truly free society, we are going to be more prosperous than any other system. Now, some will claim that you can't do that because it's heartless, you have no compassion, you have to have safety nets, you have to take care of people, somebody might smoke something that you don't like, and somebody might eat something you don't like, and on and on. So they just don't quite understand that individuals, when they live in a free society, you take this role, when you have the right to your life, that you have to suffer the consequences too. But does that mean we're going to be worse off? No, I don't believe so for a minute. There's going to be more wealth, but there will still be people in need. There's no doubt about it, but there will be fewer. And the main responsibility will be for ourselves, for our families, our friends, our neighbors, our church, our community. And for the most part, since there will be so much more wealth, they will be taken care of. But we have lost faith and confidence in how freedom works. And if we had that confidence, I don't think we would have to back off from people claiming that we're selfish and self-centered. The whole only system of government that is truly humanitarian, if we care about our fellow man, is the free market and freedom for the individual. That is humanitarian. Optimistic this can happen. I'd be pessimistic if we don't change things, if these ideas don't spread, because I know what it has led to in other countries. But if we do the right things, I think we could work our way out of this rather quickly. It's when government comes in and tries to solve all the problems. The reason the Depression lasted so long is we entered an age where the problems had to be all solved by government. Hoover did it, and Roosevelt did it, and went on and led to war and all these kind of problems. And right now, we're doing the same thing again. Here we have this mess with the housing bubble collapsing. The housing bubble was co-created by the Federal Reserve System and the government. And what are they doing now? Creating more money to try to patch the bubble up again. You have to just let it go. Let the prices of houses come down. Let the people who have less money be able to buy a house. In a negative way about what they did in the Depression. You know, there were tough times in the Depression. I was born in the Depression. Don't recall it. But back then, people were very poor, and they were hungry, and they were starving, so the government wanted to help. So they came in and paid farmers to plow their crops under. It doesn't make any sense. So what are we doing now? We have the same kind of problem. People are poor, they're hungry, oil prices are high, so we're paying farmers to burn, you know, sell their corn and burn the corn and help push the price of oil up. Yeah. So governments can't solve these problems. They're not, let me tell you, I know a few of the politicians and I know a few of the bureaucrats, and they don't know how to run the economy. Believe me, they don't. And they don't know how to run your life. You know, generally speaking, in this country, it's recognized that intellectual freedom and First Amendments pretty well recognize the right to your religious beliefs, which means that something as important as caring for your own soul, we turn that responsibility over to you. And intellectually, we allow people to read basically what they want, unless they want to regulate the internet or something else. But they allow us to have intellectual discourse. You're allowed to read about socialism and understand what communism is all about. So we're not frightened by that. But for some reason, in the last 50 or 60 years, we as a people have accepted the notion that we're not smart enough to know what to put into our bodies. And I would say it's time that we assume that responsibility. If our soul is our own to protect and our intellect is to protect, our religious values are ours to protect, why is it that we can't decide on our own what we put into our own bodies? I mean, you have freedom of religion. Some people do some pretty silly and dumb things with their religious values, but we sort of tolerate that, and intellectually the same way. But when it comes to what people smoke and drink and eat, the government has to put their seal of approval on it. And then, lo and behold, they come along and they think, they've decided, you know, in 1937, that the worst thing any individual could do in this country would be to continue to smoke marijuana. Now, I don't approve intellectually of all the things people think and write about or what they do in religion. And I certainly don't approve a lot of things personally, how people spend their money, gambling, and use of drugs and all this. I can condemn it, raise my kids a certain way. But there's a basic principle here that you take the idea of marijuana. Up until 1937, It was permissible in this country. The federal government then decided to make it illegal. And some states have said that smoking marijuana isn't all that bad. It might have some medicinal benefits to it. And so they've legalized it. So there's two things going on here. One, the personal choice issue. Do you have the right to decide what you should smoke and drink? But the other issue is, should the states have the right to regulate? If they've legalized something over, you know, to make that point, why is it that the federal government can come in, override all state laws, and put people in prison for doing these things, even if they have never committed a violent crime? Those laws are not very violent. World that has more prisoners than the United States, and that is in China. I would say it's not that we're bad people. I would say that we probably just have too many laws. Yeah. Many of the prisoners that have been involved with the war on drugs have not committed violent acts or victimless crimes, and it costs a lot of money to keep them in prison. Sometimes in some states, individuals who have committed violent acts, rapists and murderers, are getting out under so many years. And if an individual have been involved in non-violent crimes with drugs, can get a mandatory life sentence. Our country doesn't, I mean, we're not making any sense whatsoever. It's kind of a change. Sometimes they want to accuse us, if you legalize something, you endorse it. But like I point out, intellectually, religious, and personal habits are your choice to make. But once they get this idea that they can regulate everything we put into our mouths, then they regulate also things like vitamins and nutritional products. And that is what's coming too. Guess who wants to regulate it? The drug companies with the WTO, they want to tell us who can buy and sell and regulate nutritional products and all our vitamins. So that we do not need. The other day I mentioned in one crowd, which I generally don't mention this, but on this subject I brought this up and I was surprised with the reaction, is that I introduced a piece of legislation to allow individuals to transport and drink raw milk if they wanted to. That's a freedom issue with me, because I was raised in a dairy, and I imagine my dad would turn over in his grave if he found out that I was out there promoting raw milk or something like that. But nevertheless, now the issue is there. Why in the world would the federal government come in and say that you as an individual have come to the conclusion that you would like to and think raw milk is beneficial? Those decisions should be your own, not the government. But we are inundated with thousands and thousands of pages of regulations. Regulations not written by the Congress, thousands and thousands of pages of regulations that nobody understands in our tax code. And all these really laws are illegal. I mean, only the Congress is supposed to write laws, not the regulators. So my advice is, let's keep working at this. Let's refine the arguments and the understanding of what liberty is. I've made an attempt to bring all these ideas together with the new book that has just come out, the Revolution, a Manifesto, hopefully brings people together, know and understand the issues. I was told many years ago by a favorite individual of mine, Leonard Reed, who ran the Foundation for Economic Education. He says, your first responsibility, and he points to me, is to learn the issues and understand them. He said, if you know and understand the issues, and I'm relaying this message to you, that there'll be a role for you to play. People will come to you. You don't have to go and wring somebody's neck or grab them and just the way we do internationally. We say we're good, we're going over there, and said, you know, we give them two options. You do as we tell you or we'll bomb you. If you do what we tell you, we'll send you money. I like the other way is, why don't we just set an example? And that's what we should do as individuals. Know and understand how we can defend sound money and a constitution, property rights, voluntary contracts, why contracts, social contracts, and economic contracts are exactly the same. Morally, we have two obligations. That is, never hurt anybody, never steal their property, and always do what we tell people to do. If people don't fulfill their promises and their contracts, and they don't respect other people's lives and property, it doesn't work very well. But those aren't very complicated rules. It's pretty simple. It's sort of the golden rule of politics. And internationally, it's a golden rule. When you think about what we do in other countries, and I frequently will bring this up, is how would we feel? How would we feel if China came here? They look different than us. They have different religions. They have a different political system. They might want to protect their oil in the Gulf of Mexico, and they might want to put some military bases, if they were powerful enough, on our land. How would we feel about that? We'd be annoyed. I claim there would be no division among us, Republicans and the Democrats, independents. We'd all strongly believe in the Second Amendment, and we'd do what we could to get rid of them. Of what freedom is all about is tolerance and understanding and assuming responsibility. It's been available to us. We've had a taste of it. We've tested it. It's been fantastic. We've been drifting, though. We've drifted for the last 100 years away from those principles, and financially, especially since 1971, we have drifted toward a gigantic increase in the size of our government, internationally as well as domestically. But the good news is it's all coming to an end. The challenge is, what is it going to be replaced with? If we have our way, which I am going to continue to work for and struggle for, we are going to restore this greatness of our country and restore liberty to America. Thank you very much.
Good evening, Dr. Paul. I'm Diane Helgen. Thank you for coming to Montana. Would you please address the health care issue and the dilemma that it's in? You've been and will be obstetrician before. Thank you.
Okay, she asked for me to address the health care issue. One thing I alluded to a little bit medically is the freedom of choice in medicine. And I talked about vitamins and nutritional products. What we really ought to do is make sure that there's no prohibition or interference with freedom of choice, and governments frequently will do this because they will pay for some services and not others. But we're in a mess medically because we've had managed care by the government now for more than 35 years, since the early 70s, through our tax laws and regulations, and managed care doesn't work. And the ERISA laws and the PPOs have all been legislated. What we need to do is get control back into the hands of the patient. And one thing that we can do, we're moving in that direction, is for you to opt out of the system, where you can take $3,000, $4,000, I'd make it unlimited, all the money that you spend for medical care, you get it, you know, back off your taxes. And buy major medical, and we don't have insurance. What we have today is prepaid care, and everybody has prepaid care, and they might pay $5 or a copay, which is way below the market, but the patient has to get control. When I started in medicine, we had no managed care. The patient was always charged the least. Today, the patient is always charged the most. And if they're not on government benefits, they're immediately put on Medicaid or something else in order for the hospital and the labs, everybody, to charge the maximum. So we've done everything wrong so far, and unfortunately, because so many people are unhappy, the clamor now is for more government and a national health care system, but national health care system will not be our answer.
Dr. Paul, you mentioned the word democracy. I mean, I hate that word. We're a constitutional republic, and we want to help these other nations, give them our constitution. We're not using it. And one more thing is Ronald Reagan cut taxes, but he didn't cut the amount of government employees, and it caused the greatest deficit this country ever seen. So we have to start eliminating 52% of the workforce works for the government, directly or indirectly. We have more people working for government than we do without government. Well, that's just two comments.
Okay. Well, it is true. The size of government was not reduced to the 80, and I agree with you about the word democracy. And I use that to make a point in the talk, but there is a democratic process of voting, and this whole idea about us, the ridiculousness of us fighting overseas, so-called to promote democracy, and you're right, we want to strike for is a constitutional republic, and that was stated clearly right when the Constitution was written.
Dr. Paul, my name is Luke Venters. I live in Polson, Montana. I have a question. Thank you very much. I have a question for you about H.R. 1955, the Violent Radicalization Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act. It states in there that homegrown terrorism is the planned or threatened use of force or violence. And because force and violence are separated by the word or, that means our government considers force to be something other than violence. I looked that up, and it's the ability to affect social change through political commentary, deductive reasoning, logic, things like that. How scary is this to you that homegrown terrorism may now be the ability to wage a logical argument?
Well, once again, I think it's another piece of atrocious legislation, and they write that in that way because they want not to interpret it any way they want. You know, they like to get those laws in the books and it gives them some reassurance, but if they don't get what they want, they just, you know, issue an executive order and they do it anyway. But I think it's a very, very dangerous piece of legislation. And it means that any type of an organization, you know, if you happen to have been a donor to an organization and somebody else was, who knows what it's going to invite. Now, that's another can of worms for us, another real threat.
Not as educated as he is. Ron Paul, you're a true American hero. I'd like you to speak a little bit about the North American Union and the Real ID. Yeah.
Okay, the North American Union, of course, I'd be positively opposed to, as well as NAFTA and CAFTA and all the other international organizations. The Real ID, I voted against, and yet there were a lot of conservatives who didn't believe that it would be a national ID card, but I understand the people of Montana have spoken, and they do not like one of the ways they got that passed was it was thought that that was the way you controlled illegal immigration, and therefore if you voted against it, you were for illegal immigration. But that's the way all types of legislation is passed. You know, going into Colombia militarily to protect oil, it was always done, oh, we have to stop the drugs. You know, the drug war is used as an excuse to do things. So those kind of things are usually just excuses.
Mark Ranch, Paradise, Montana. I don't believe that our economy can handle another presidential cycle, another four-year cycle. I want to see Ron Paul as president this year. How can we do that?
Well, the only way you can do it is first win the nomination in September, which is an uphill battle, and you'd need a bit of a miracle to do that, and then you'd have to make sure that the media was very fair and balanced. So we didn't get a fair shake. So yes, I know all things are possible, but I don't want to be naive and think, well, yes, that's around the bend, but we have to believe that the future can be better. We have to do whatever we can to do our best, and the future is not exactly totally in our hands, which is do our best we can.
I believe!
God bless you, Dr. Paul. God bless America. You said many times that this is our campaign, and this is our revolution that is taking place. What is the status at this point financially of the campaign, and is it time for another money bomb?
Well, financially, we, you know, we've been written up in the paper, of course, having raised a lot of money in the campaign. We still have money in the bank, and it's a couple million dollars. And so we're not short. That means we can continue to do the things we need to do. But we have to lay the plans, you know, between now and September. And this requires some planning, and exactly what we're going to be doing in Minneapolis. We may be gathering together in Minneapolis, for all we know. One thing that they write about the campaign is that we ran a very, very frugal campaign. Even when I look back and the independent sources say we ran a frugal campaign, I get worried because we still, there's a lot of money involved. But they know that I've never had a campaign, I've never had a debt, we're not going to have a debt, and I feel very grateful that supporters like you have been very generous and kept us very solvent. And there will always be a battle to fight, and that money will always be used to defend liberty and promote our cause.
Dr. Paul, you made it clear that you have no plans to run under a third party. Assuming that John McCain is the Republican nominee for president, I plan on making an addition to my sign in the fall that says, "Write in Ron Paul." My question is, who are you going to vote for?
Pardon me?
My question is, who are you going to vote for?
I've already said who I was not going to vote for. I don't need to say that again. But we'll see who all the candidates are.
Dr. Paul, if you were to describe the underlying values that guide your policy and separate you as a candidate from the other people running for president, what would these underlying values that guide your candidacy be?
I think I've mentioned it in the talk, and that is a commitment never to use force and violence to tell other people what to do. I don't think it's any more complicated than that.
I have a statement and a question. My name is Pete, and first the statement is just like with the drug policy and all the other things that you've been talking about how it's your choice whether or not I condone what you want to do. Same thing with abortion. Her body, her choice. I'm a guy, even if it's my baby, it's her choice, period. Just a thought. That's just an idea, just thought I'd throw it out there as a government standpoint. Okay, now the question is your administration going to pursue the Bush administration for war crimes?
Who am I saying again?
Pursuing the Bush administration for war crimes.
Probably not. Mainly because the war crimes are, the criminals are so many. I mean, the real dereliction of duty came from the Congress. Congress could stop the whole thing. Congress they should have just never given them this pseudo-authority and never given them a nickel. Assume the responsibility, it wouldn't have happened. So yes, he's guilty of a lot, and it was more than just being misled. A lot of lies were told, and it was so deliberate. There was a lot of special interest. I don't think it's going to be as productive as some other things. But I would like to just mention the issue very briefly about the abortion issue, because I am right to life. I believe that. On the basic moral principle I debate, just said, I can't use force or violence to hurt other people. And as an OB doctor, I mean, I have dealt with life, at the very early stages and at the late stages. And all of a sudden, here we had a Supreme Court come along and rule that even up into the eighth and ninth month, if a doctor decided to do an abortion, you could get paid for it. Yet if a girl delivers a baby 1 minute after birth and throws the baby away, she's arrested for murder. But I get paid 1 minute before, and she gets arrested for murder 1 minute afterwards. There's something screwy about that. There's something that has to be resolved. And the unborn has legal rights. They get inheritance right at the time of conception. If I do harm to the unborn, I can get sued, and rightfully so. So if there's a homicide and they kill the mother and the child, there's a double homicide. If you're in an accident, you're liable. If you kill a woman's child in an accident, you're responsible and liable. So there's a lot of legal precedent for it. But then there's also the complicated, very, very emotional reasons why people think they should have abortions at all. And sometimes it isn't all that easy. But this is the magnificent thing about our Constitution, is we don't want, you know, a 5-4 vote in the Supreme Court dictating every single thing everybody in the country does. The states should be able to decide.
Steve Robinson from Lake County, which went for you in the caucus in February. Revolution is a work in progress, and looking forward from 2008, if you don't, what are your ideas, what are your plans, what do you think we should be doing looking forward from here through 2008 and beyond?
Well, I think everybody has a responsibility, but it won't all be the same. Some may decide that the biggest contribution they can have, if they're in college right now, they might like journalism. And they might like to be a teacher. They might want to be a constitutional lawyer. They might want to support another candidate. They might want to become a candidate. But to me, like I said earlier, the most important thing is really know and understand the issues so you can defend them, and there will be a job. For me, things will go on. There will be, I've always had, since 1976, I've had an educational foundation. And it was small, and not many people heard about it, but maybe a lot more people will hear about it later on, and I'll be, very much involved in no matter what. But everybody's going to be involved, but not everybody's going to do exactly the same thing, and that's good. You know, I think that's fine. But it's when a whole generation grows up and moves into important positions where they literally are writing for newspapers, and they're in journalism, they're in television, and all of these things. So that's what influences a country, is an attitude, a prevailing attitude. But I still think education is one of the most important things, but political action is very important too. All I've ever said in the campaign, and anytime you get involved, is that you ought to have a lot of fun doing it, because if you think too seriously about it, it can be depressing. And when you get working with people who have one goal of freedom, even though they might not agree with you on all your personal values, you still can have a lot of fun doing this. And I think a lot of people took my advice on that, and they had a lot of fun in this campaign. So I hope you've had a lot of fun out here.
I'm a student at the University of Montana, and a lot of my classmates and I are concerned that maybe smaller government might mean cutting funding for educational institutions. I was just wondering if you see education as a right or a privilege, and if you were to be elected, what your policy would be on that. Thank you.
Well, nobody has a right to an education. Like having a right to medical care and a right to a job and a right to a house and all these things. You have a right to your life. You have a right to your liberty. You have a right to keep what you earn. But when it comes to, the federal government shouldn't even be involved in education. Like I said, I'd have competing currencies instead of getting rid of the Fed. And one day, I'd have competing currencies and work out of it. what I would do if I could save these hundreds of billions of dollars from our foreign policy, I would tide the people over that are on retirement benefits. There's no Social Security money there. But I'm not picking on Social Security beneficiaries. They've been told that they were going to get their money back. I wouldn't cut them. I would tide them over and take care of them. I would take care of people who have medical needs. I would take care of some of the educational needs. I'd much rather do that. You know, I mentioned about the infrastructure. I don't want to blow up bridges in Iraq and rebuild them. I want to take care of the bridges here. But what we could do is, how do you do it best? How would you have more money in education? You'd have more money, you got a healthy economy, not wasting all this money overseas, and the money stayed at home or stayed in your pocket. You know, this is where you would get the money. If you say, well, what can I do to help a college kid? Well, make sure that you don't have any taxes whatsoever while you're in college. Well, you get to keep everything. Give tax credits to students or parents, you know, for the money they spend on education. But there's a lot of things that can be done. But before, just like I said, in medicine, we charged the least amount, and people weren't turned away. The churches ran the hospitals, and everybody got medical care. Same way in education. When I went to college, I got a job running a soda fountain on the college campus, and I made $325 a semester to be the manager of this soda fountain. But that paid my whole tuition. Costs weren't high. Today you're dealing with cost of medicine, cost of education, and those prices are inflated more than anything else. So you can't look at these as an education problem. You have to look at that as a spending problem, foreign policy spending, printing money, inflation. Because the inflation, the prices go up in some areas more than in other areas. The government's more involved in medicine, education, and housing. And that's where you have the most amount of inflation. Of course, now the housing bubble collapsed. So, yes, a free market would help you tremendously. Costs would be down, and there'd be much more greater incentive for you to work and get your money. In medical school, if you didn't have enough money, there was an endowment that you could borrow your money and pay 1%. And some doctors did that. I didn't have to do that. I put my wife to work instead.
This is something I consider of great concern to me and many that I know. I just want to know, will you not only support, but will you fight for a new independent investigation as to what happened on September 11th?
Yes, I am for more investigation. I believe the investigation was a cover-up of ineptness, you know, and hiding. I have no idea exactly what went on, but I'm not happy. But what you have to be careful about is, how are you going to absolutely be sure the next investigation is better than the last investigation? Government investigations have never been very trustworthy. I mean, that is where our real problem is. But I think it did not answer the questions and exactly the motivations and what really went on. We don't have those answers.
Dr. Paul, I'm Catherine Gold from Colson, Montana, and I have a foreign policy question for you. I'm particularly interested in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and I want to ask you what your policy is on that, what you plan to do, and where you stand.
The Palestinian-Israeli conflict is, I would treat them both friendly and kindly and equally, and I wouldn't favor one side over the other, and I would encourage them to work out their differences. I think the fact that we're there keeps some of these solutions from coming about. I think in spite of the fact that the litmus test for loyalty to Israel is only if we send tens of billions of dollars, many tens of billions of dollars there, and then we try to balance it by sending tens of billions of dollars to the Arabs and promise protection to Saudi and Egypt and all these other places. I want to be friends with people, trade with people, get along with them, but not to give them any money whatsoever.
Hi, Ron. I'm Jim Farley. I spent a lot of time in your district back in the late 60s and early 70s. And I'm born and bred in Texas, but I can tell you one thing. I've lived in Hamilton, Montana for the last 11 years. I've never seen more patriotic, freedom-loving people. And now, I thought I'd never say it, but the greatest state in the union in the state of Montana. And we were proud to support you in your re-election efforts in your congressional seat. Good for you. I have a very grave concern. I'm sure a lot of other people in here too, as small businessmen, seeing what's happening, I guess my notion is that it looks like it's too organized and perpetrated, this complete meltdown systemically of our financial system. Is there any credence to the possibility that this is all intended? So we can crash the U.S. dollar. You look at the dollar index, it's just plummeting. So they can introduce the Amero. Because every single major event in this country, all the wars, 9/11, they had to create a scare event in this country to get the masses to support implementation of a new program. And Bush is meeting next week in New Orleans with the Mexican and Canadian authorities. The question was, is this happening?
Well, I'd have to know what's in the minds of each individual, and I can't say for sure, but I do know that it's very intentional that they debase the currency and they control it, and they understand inflation, and they know that they benefit by it. Whether they would intentionally collapse it, they have too many benefits when it's going up and the bubble's being blown up and they make all this money. So it's conceivable, but one thing for sure is they probably anticipate and know what the crisis is like. They might be anti-gold and anti-constitution, but they're the kind of people who, when the time comes, they'll probably be in charge of the gold mines or something like that. So there is a lot of power and influence behind it. Okay, thank you very much.
I want to ask a favor of you guys. What I want to do is allow you guys to shake hands, take a few pictures, and we can stack the chairs over on this side of the room to make room for the people who want to do that. So if you can stack some chairs over here to make some room, Dr. Paul will spend a little bit of time over here on the side of the stage. Shake some hands. Thanks for coming. Vote for Ron Paul in June.